Greetings, podcast listeners. This is Dan with Spark R&D, and welcome to episode 9 of the Spark R&D podcast. In this episode, we speak with the co-founder of Nitro Snowboards, Tommy DeLago. You might have noticed I said we, and I wasn't referring to myself in the plural, or Spark R&D in general. Will Ritter, our co-owner and lead designer, joined the conversation with Tommy. As you might imagine, Will loves splitboard history. He knew that Nitro actually had a factory split model back in the early 90s, and it was Will that suggested he might make a great guest on the show. If you can remember way back to the early 90s, snowboarding on its own was still pretty new, so the fact that a splitboard even existed is significant. Will and I talk with Tommy about the first split models and the early days of backcountry travel. We also dive into what drew Tommy to snowboarding and how Nitro Snowboards was formed. It was really fun to chat with Tommy. He's a really great guy, an industry legend, and had some awesome insight into the early days of splitboarding and snowboarding. It was also cool to have Will in on the conversation. He actually loves podcasts and splitboarding, of course, so it made a lot of sense to have him join in. With that, I bring you episode 9 of the Spark R&D podcast. Hey, Tommy, thanks for taking the time to join us on the Spark podcast today.
Hey, no worries. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So we're on a little bit of a time difference, so I know that it's in the evening, so we'll just try and keep things moving. What time is it over there in Germany right now?
It's about a little after 7 in the evening right now, which is, it's fine. I'm still awake.
Perfect. Before we get into, some of the history and the snowboarding and the splitboarding that we kind of wanted to chat about today, I wanted you to, maybe could you just tell me a little bit about yourself? Where'd you grow up? Where are you calling from, or where you're talking from right now?
I'm actually calling from Oberammergau, Germany, which is in the Bavarian Alps. So we're about an hour south of Munich, where the mountains start, Garmisch. Innsbruck is about an hour away in Austria. So this is pretty much the first mountain range that you hit when you come to the Alps from the north. And this is the kind of like a little town. I was actually born and raised here in this town that I still live in. Never left this place, I guess. It's kind of like a little tiny town, but it's interesting because it's kind of a touristy town. It's kind of famous for its wood carvings, and there's the what we call the Passion Play. It's like a historical theater play about Jesus Christ, and every 10 years they put it on, and there's hundreds of thousands of people coming by. So it's small, but pretty well connected for being this small of a town.
There you go. Very cool. For all the podcast listeners, too, I feel like I didn't let everyone know that Will Ritter, the co-founder, lead designer still here at Spark, is actually joining us for the interview, too. So I feel like before he just starts chiming in and they think my voice has changed.
Yep, that's me.
All right, so thanks for that intro, Tommy. That definitely gives us a little place for everything. It sounds like a really cool place to grow up, and it makes sense that you decided to stick around. I'm imagining this is where some of like your roots of snowboarding kind of took place, having grown up in the mountains. And
this is pretty much where it happened. I'm literally like 5 minutes away to, from the chairlift, at like 1 minute hike to the next little hill, really. So it's really right there.
Awesome.
Yeah. You were, someone that is credited with helping popularize the sport of snowboarding just in general, but certainly in Europe. I know Peter Bauer's name comes up a lot with that. Can you talk a little bit about, in the beginning, what drew you to snowboarding?
I grew up, just being very, fascinated by, the snowboard, the skateboard surf culture in the U.S. specifically, of course, because it was also at that point, I'm talking about the 70s, there was just an emerging, culture of skateboarding happening here. Surfing as a sport really, didn't exist, at least not, in the mountains, obviously. Windsurfing was kind of an option, but without a car, if you're like 14, 15 years old, you just don't do that either. And it really always was kind of drawn towards surfing. It's always something that I really, really wanted to do. So at some point, snowboarding became an interesting alternative. And the way I got introduced to snowboarding was when I was a skater in the 70s, I had a subscription for a skateboarder magazine. And there was like a dip in popularity of skateboarding, and that dropped down. And they actually changed the name of the magazine, and the content already had changed to being like an all, you know, kind of an action sports magazine. It was actually called Action Now. And during that time, they actually started showing, you know, BMX and even motocross and skating, surfing, and also the first images of snowboarding, you know, guys like Tom Sims, Jake Burton, Chuck Barfoot. So that's where I saw my first photos of, man, this is pretty much as close as I can get in the mountains to surfing. So that was really my way to get into snowboarding. I really wanted to surf, and that was as close as I could get.
Early on, you know, say North America, Europe, I think was the same. There was just a lot of like confusion as to like what snowboarding was. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't widely accepted in the beginning. And there's a lot of, we see a lot of stories, you know, out of like the 80s, 90s of resorts just flat out not letting snowboarders ride the lifts. Was that the same? Did you meet some of the same resistance in Europe?
Well, not really in the very beginning, but it was, you know, in the very beginning, and I'm talking, you know, anywhere between, you know, 78, 79, and even all the way up to like, you know, 84, 85, maybe. It was not an issue really because I was the only guy. So I knew the people who ran the lift, and I was up there skiing and, you know, snowboarding. But then, you know, the snowboarding part that you were doing in the resort was really limited because you just took the first couple of chairs and you're just riding as long as they hadn't groomed the snow yet because there was no bindings and just had like rubber straps. Yeah. And that was fine. I didn't create any, you know, problems. And they knew I was kind of a, you know, I did all kinds of freestyle skiing and mono skiing and whatnot. So they knew I always had weird stuff, you know, with me. It became a problem when it became popular, you know, like from one day to the next, you know, I was up there and like, there's all of a sudden 20, 30 guys up there, and they got scared. They got scared about insurance. They got scared about, okay, what's the right way to use the lift, chair? You know, there's a lot of T-bars in Europe that people are like, man, you know, messing up the runs, you know, going up there, you're creating all these bumps and people fall. And I'm pretty ashamed to say that actually our resort here in town was probably the last resort. And then, a lot of resorts closed. And this resort was almost, or probably the last resort in Germany that reopened to snowboarding at some point in the early 90s. I still remember a conversation I had with the mayor. I actually ran in. I was on a train with the mayor, and he's like, "Hey, Tommy, we're opening for snowboarding again." Like, yeah, that's great, you know. And at that point, I had a snowboard school camp operation, like from 87 to like 92 or 3. And I had moved everything like next town. It was a little resort that a friend of mine owns, and he did everything for me. He gave me a cabin, you know, to put all my rental boards and everything in there. And, you know, I was like, hey, I'm never going to leave and go back to you guys, you know, now that you dissed me for like, you know, 5 or 6 years, you know. So we had that. But it was like, for me personally, it felt like it came in super late. But of course, it coincided with, you know, the popularity, you know, jump that we saw in the late 80s, probably.
So you weren't allowed back until 93 or so?
Something like this. It was maybe 90, maybe 90, maybe it was 91 or 92. I don't remember exactly. Well, it was the early 90s for sure. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And they never harassed me personally either. You know, so when I did go up there occasionally, they were okay, but they wouldn't allow me to go up there with my students when I was like coaching, you know. So it was kind of a weird thing. So I was just like, you know, you guys, you just do whatever you want. I just go to all these other places, you know. So, yeah. It's a shame.
A lot of the video I saw of you, like from the early days that, you know, we were just kind of talking about as snowboarding got more and more popular, and you are in some amazing outfits, by the way, too. But I was wondering, you know, because a lot of that looks like backcountry type terrain. At least, you know, you didn't look like you were always at the resort. Were you able, or was it because you either couldn't be at the resort, or, you know, just following your surf roots and wanting to actually, you know, surf the powder, which is not the same as surfing a groomer?
Well, yeah, in the beginning there was no other option. There was really, you know, we were just hiking all the, you know, there's a lot of backcountry here. There's a lot of pretty popular, smaller, like, you know, little, you know, 1 hour, 2 hour hikes, you know, like even half an hour. There's a lot of stuff like this that people do locally. or like within a, like an area of like 1 hour drive up, you know, like small little hikes. There's like the mountains here are not really high. So there's many, many options. You just can have fun hiking little runs here and there. And that's really what I did with, you know, a couple of friends for the most part. So it was only a few days where you can actually use the lift, because like I said, you can only use them for maybe a couple hours, or maybe only a couple of runs, you know, depending on how quick they were grooming everything. And as soon as they got done grooming, you had to leave because you couldn't ride there anymore. It was just a purely a matter of bindings, really. With no high backs, no bindings, that was all you could do. You know, it's basically like snowboarding is today. That's what it was.
Sure. It's come full circle, right?
Yeah, and I'm so stoked to see that, you know, people just rediscovering that simplicity, that it actually comes back to surfing. All you need is a board, and that's it. You don't need anything else, really, you know, unless somebody's trying to push it on you, but that's all you need, you know. And I really enjoy seeing that, like, man, yeah, this is pretty cool. People rediscover the simplicity of just hiking a little run, you know. That's cool.
I've seen some snowboards that are full inserts for split boards too, which is pretty cool. I've also like run into some people at different split fests and events that have like taken the high backs off of our bindings, so like they've modded them out, so like so it's very surf style on the way down. They just mostly use it for the way up and just enough to keep you on the board a little bit, but it's real soft.
I mean, you know, I mean, of course, obviously you always have you know, at that point you even have the snowshoe options, but actually at that point we never thought about snowshoes. You know, we really thought about you know, just hiking up. And actually one of my very, very first snowboard was almost like a split board today, you know, because this is like, again, 78, 79, I don't know. We manufactured snowboards all kinds of ways, you know, surfboard style, friends laminating with foam cores or wood cores with family, you know, all kinds of things. One of the things I built was a snowboard actually made out of two skis with just a wooden, like a plywood plate connecting them, you know. So it was like a catamaran almost, you know, with two skis, like cut, like really short, cut just like maybe 4, you know, feet tall, and just connected them with a piece of waterproof plywood, you know, and that was a snowboard too, you know. Sure. So the super rudimental splitboard, even, you know, you just couldn't split it apart for hiking, obviously.
And that was, you were just going up boot packs mostly back then?
Yeah.
And was it in like avalanche terrain? Like what was the state of avy awareness back then?
It was pretty mellow terrain, really, you know. And like I said, you know, like our altitude here is at 850 meter for the town, and then the peaks are like 1600-1700. So it's not crazy. There's a few areas here where you run into dangerous areas, but it's pretty limited. So for the most part, the runs we did were pretty safe. You know, it's just like there's a lot of trees, you know, some open, you know, turns here and there. But it was pretty safe.
Yeah. Were the skiers back then, were they boot packing as well? Or were they on Telemark, or what was the...
No, Telemark didn't really happen there at that point. This is really like the backcountry skiing, like my parents, like all their life, they were like, you know, hardcore backcountry, you know, skiing. Like my father was head of the ski patrol for the longest time. And so that's most of what they did. They almost never rode the resort. So they did, you know, the classic type of, you know, touring skiing, not to be compared to what we see now, like where we have this trend of people that use it as kind of an exercise, especially around here where people just drive up from after work, headlamp, and they just run up and almost don't care about how they come down. It's more of an exercise thing. They're like more like the backcountry, like a full day tour, you know, complete day enjoyment, you know, type of a, you know, backcountry tourist, and that was what, you know, what the skiers did, really. But that was more like a very, very, you know, mountaineering influence scene, definitely. And it had nothing to do with us. We were skaters, surfers. It was completely different from what we did, really.
Sure. So going into, like, you know, the mid-80s, you were riding for Sims, rocking the awesome neon, and really like popularizing splitboarding in Europe, or excuse me, snowboarding. I'm so used to saying splitboarding all the time. But popularizing snowboarding, we'll get to the splitboarding part. And then, you know, you got to a point and you founded Nitro, and I just wanted you to talk a little bit about like how that came to be, where you got to the point where like, you know what, I'm going to go out on my own and start a company like that. And before I have to do the follow-up question too, I was curious because, you know, I know you're a Germany Euro-based brand, although you're worldwide now, of course. But it always talks about Seattle was the founding point, and I was always curious, like, why Seattle was the location.
Yeah, it's kind of a long story to try to make it, you know, reasonably short. And my original partner and I, like my partner, he was, at the time we started all this, he was actually the general manager for North Sails windsurfing equipment, who are also based out of here, kind of close to about half an hour away from here. And he was responsible for the international sales, and he had a U.S. distributor in Seattle. And this company, in turn, they were the licensee for GNU snowboards. GNU at that point was kind of a mix, you know, Mike and Pete were like, you know, more involved with what they just had started Liptek, and GNU, they had kind of like, they had some partners in there. It was kind of a mishmash. And so they, you know, whoever they or the partners decided to license off the name to this company in Seattle. And those guys in turn turned to Sepp, my partner, and that was before I even met him, and asked him if he was interested in helping out finding distribution in Europe and also helping with the sourcing, because the boards and the bindings were already made in Europe at that point. Then he contacted me because he needed help in the technical R&D side. I had spent a number of years organizing, running the snowboard tests for the biggest snowboard magazine here in Germany and Austria, Switzerland. So I had some knowledge. Actually, it was a year where I literally rode every single snowboard on the market. So I had some backcountry and some backcountry. See, I'm doing the same thing. Some background there. So, you know, he hit me up if I wanted to help develop that GNU line. And at some point, we figured that, you know, and again, I have to emphasize, I'm not talking about Mike or Pete. You know, those investor dudes that they had in there were not the funniest person to deal with. So we decided, no, this is not really our thing, and let's rather start our own brand. And we convinced our, also at that point, partner in Seattle to not continue that licensing situation and rather start our own brand. And that's how it started. So it did really start in Seattle with, you know, basically three partners, one from Seattle, Sepp and myself. And we had our, you know, design, marketing, and, you know, base for the direction of the company for a number of years in Seattle. And at some point we started to, you know, split ways, you know, and we never had a full on main office ever since. You know, I'm based here in Germany. We do most of the technical R&D and some of the marketing stuff out of here, sales international out of Switzerland. Most of the design stuff is out of the US, you know, or Canada for boots and bindings and boards and graphics and everything. So we're extremely split up in different countries. We have little small offices in all these places. You know, we just find the right people and just keep them where they are, where they're happy, and you know, try to work kind of like a, you know, I don't know how you call that. We don't have a big one. We have a legal central, but not like this is where everyone sits every day, you know. Sure. So it's kind of different. So yeah, that's the long story short about Seattle and how it started.
Can you talk a little bit just quickly about like the name too? Because I thought that was kind of a cool story about how you stuck with that too. It's funny how, you know, who knows, you know, it's like almost 30 years later and how iconic that name would become. But I thought how you guys got that name was pretty cool.
That's just pretty random. I mean, I was like, you know, you didn't care about like registering trademarks or anything at that point. You know, it was just... Nitro was initially a model name for a board in the 1989-90 GNU line. And so once we decided, you know, we want to start our own thing, we need a name for this brand. We just went through the names that we had just, you know, a couple months ago run through for model names, and Nitro was the name that stuck. Like, okay, there was all kinds of names that we, you know, played around with. Some of them actually became... you know, Baker boards, skateboards. Mm-hmm. Baker snowboards was one of the options back in the day, you know, because we were so close to Mount Baker, you know, and we're all sitting there in Seattle at that point, you know. So it was just, you know, random. Like Nitro sounds good, you know, and it would have worked as a model name. So it's like, okay, Nitro snowboards sounds great. That's it, you know. So, it was just like, oh, we need a name. Which one? Yeah, okay, that's it, you know.
You were talking a moment ago about being kind of a spread out global type company without like a main headquarters. I kind of noticed you have a big Utah, Salt Lake City kind of following, it seems. Is there any reason why that local that mountain range kind of drew Nitro in, or is it just like one person and it grew from there?
It's there's we have a bunch of kind of interestingly mixed or changing history. I mean, one thing, we have a pretty bumpy history of US distribution, for one thing to say. We started out with, of course, with the people in Seattle. Once we parted ways with them, Dakine was our distributor for a long time, and we were super stoked. But then they grew so fast, they had to focus on their whole business. And then there's a bunch of different distributors, and with this change of distributor, of course, sometimes apparently the structure of the shops that we work with somehow seem to have changed. And in the early days, we had a pretty tight connection with Salty Peaks in Salt Lake, with Drew Higan and Dennis Nazari and those guys. Drew was always a big powder board, swallowtail guy. He always was the guy that rode all those big powder boards that we made even back in the day. So if you look at, some of the early Nitro videos, you'll see a lot of, Salty Peak stuff there. You see, I think we did like we filmed with the Wasatch Powder Bird. So we spent a lot of time in Salt Lake then. At some point, that whole relationship kind of split up, and we started gravitating towards Milo. And we had very strong ties with Milo Sports. They helped with, organizing distribution at some point too for a number of years. And there was a very tight connection with those guys. So we always had some sort of a foothold in Salt Lake. And there was guys like Tonino Copain and some riders that we've always worked with that were around this area. Paul Brown, our main, graphics art director, boy graphics guy, he actually moved from Southern California to Salt Lake a couple of years ago. John Cooley was, responsible for L1 Outerwear. He's out of Salt Lake. Bob Plum, photographers. There's a lot of guys that somehow gravitate around this, epicenter. And I think we were one of those satellites always gravitating around Salt Lake, I guess.
We have some contact with Griffin Siebert too, and he's out of there. And I
Yeah.
think a lot of that is he
Yeah.
just loves splitboarding, so he's
Oh yeah,
huge.
look for more interesting stuff coming from Griff next year too. So yeah, Griff's is of course kind of representing that new generation of Salt Lake guys, So yeah, it kind of continues on that way. Knut, I mean Knut Eliasson, he lives there, half of his life or something like that, yeah, we do have, quite a few ties, to that area for sure.
Yeah, well, I getting into some of the split history stuff early on in the Spark days, I was doing patent work on our split board bindings, and in the patents that were out there was this mention of this, brochure from a Nitro split board, and but without, if you look at those patents from back then, it's pretty poor, like Xerox. You can't really tell what's going on. So, I actually got in touch with Sepp back in the day, and he was nice enough to send some random dude in Montana your actual 93, 94 catalog there. And then we got to see in the flesh the first that Nitro split board, which I think Dan in some fashion will put that up on the website or whatever, so
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes for sure.
people can see it.
Okay.
And then later on, I actually got my hands on one, and so I have more pictures from that, including a sticker on it that says Salt Lake City sucks, which I think Dan, like, people actually use in the Salt Lake part. So, anyway, I was curious, we've talked super briefly, I think, at trade shows about, this split board from back in 93. And I think, I don't know how many of those you guys actually ended up putting out, but yeah, what's the origin story of the 93 Nitro split board?
I remember at our very first trade show in Munich at ISPO, in 1990, basically almost right next to us. I don't know if you're familiar with the name Fnatic, you know, for surfboards. I think they'd be SUP now. And they were the very first company I ever see, you know, with a split board. So they had a split board on their booth, you know, and I knew the guys pretty well that, you know, did that, or did Fnatic anyways. So I talked to them and how that all came together and how that all worked. And, you know, they were not the most popular company as far as snowboards, and they kind of had already gone over their peak. And but they had that board there, and I was like, man, this is so amazing. So I got one from them. And it got me, you know, got me pretty excited about like that new added mobility all of a sudden that, you know, you had, kind of, you know, closing the circle back to where, at least where I started, you know, in the backcountry. So I was pretty intrigued, you know, but they told me that they actually had a license from a guy in Switzerland. His name was Uli Bettenmann. Apparently he was the guy that put out that very first patent. Then, you know, they were not ready yet to give up on that, you know, on that solitary or that exclusive license, whatever. So it took us another year to finally, you know, they actually, you know, Fnatic was, you know, getting less and less popular. So they like gave up on snowboards. They basically gave up on snowboards altogether for some part. And so we got in touch with this guy. And also at the same time, we had a contact with Fritschi Bindings, a Swiss binding factory that's, you know, their main thing is ski touring bindings. We actually manufactured the binding that went on the snowboard. We worked with Fritschi already for our plate binding program, because at that point, you know, we're talking, you know, early 90s, hard boots and plate bindings were pretty popular. And that binding that went on that split board, of course, was a plate binding. So the most logical thing for people that already were into snowboard touring, who had touring snowboard boots, which at that point literally were the same boots as we used for hard boots snowboarding. For them, it was an easy conversion. They already had the boots. They just had to get the board and the binding. And I think this binding really was probably still the most durable, you know, binding ever made for splitboarding, because it was just a solid, you know, piece of aluminum profile and clips in front and back. And it was just a plate binding, really, you know. But it really, really got me excited. And eventually we made an arrangement with those guys from Switzerland and started making our own split boards in 93.
So it looks like the brochure we're looking at is like the original Nitro factory split. Yeah. Then if that's this year is probably correct. That's pretty cool.
So yeah, it's possible. I have all the catalogs. I have, of course, all the board split boards still too. But so it was really a... was kind of tricky, of course, because with all the, you know, with all the mounting and all this, you know, mounting systems were not as flexible as they're now with, like, you know, circular disc shape pucks or whatever we have now. You're pretty much set in your angles. You know, your riding angles were like, this is it, because they're like diamond shaped, you know, like parallelogram shaped. Maybe you see them on the photo. Yep. Pucks made out of aluminum.
Yep.
And there was only really one angle. You know, you could actually mess with the rear foot angle if you wanted to, but the front foot was pretty much set, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to, you know, use the hiking part. Uh-huh. In a straight.
Yeah, from what I saw with the one in hand, it looked like your stance choice was regular or goofy. Maybe a little bit beyond that. But.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you could, of course, you know, you mess with your wrist stance, like with your stance width, of course. Yeah. Because the rear mounting plates were like flexible in a way. You couldn't, you know, you could also mount them at a different angle if you wanted to, because there was no insert in the beginning. You just were, you know, drilling everything anyways, you know, or T-bolting, or just, our boards were made with aluminum, like, you know, top sheets.
Yeah.
So you could use regular ski mounting equipment. The only thing I really designed, you know, other than the actual board, was the clips that actually held the board together.
Oh, yeah.
Because the original Fnatic design, something I didn't like, was very cumbersome, heavy, complicated. So I designed this like a two-piece, like a slider that was operated by a binding buckle.
Gotcha.
So you actually were actively pulling two parts together, you know, so it was just locking, but it was just like actually pulling them together as much as you wanted.
Oh, that's the Tommy clip. Yeah. I didn't know. I figured it was Richie clip. So good to know.
Yeah, that was the only, that was really my only addition at that point anyways to split boarding, other than just making a board shape that was splittable.
Yeah.
Was that clip that stabilized the board because it was, you know, kind of rigid, but also allowed you to, you know, even if you have, like, you drilled it wrong or the mounting was not perfect, you was able to kind of compensate that, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, it was not as elegant as the pieces that we have now, but it did the job, you know, definitely.
Did it have edges on the inside?
How do you mean edges on the inside?
Like
I mean, the board, you mean?
Board
had edges all the way around. Yeah. It was a full on. We had to make this board in a injection molded construction, so it was not a laminated board. You know, it was a foam injected board. Because of production limitations, they were not able to, you know, to make a split board laminated at that point. So, you know, the first number of years, you know, as long as we had that particular shape, it was actually a injection molded PU board. And then later on, we went to a laminated version.
Cool. I imagine that you were out, you know, doing some product testing with this in the early days, checking out how it rode, how the bindings functioned. You obviously worked on the clips too. And then that makes me think of, you know, talking to Will about the early days of him product testing and meeting ski tours, because obviously ski touring was a little more popular, you know, what, 10, 12 years ago for us. And this is 10 years before that. Did you get some funny conversations in the backcountry when you were taking a big split board out and trying to test it out?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, I think it was one of the things that eventually became a problem for split boarding, you know, at that point, and kind of, you know, helped that first dip in popularity, I would say, maybe towards the end of the 90s, is that of course, our half boards, you know, are much wider than, at least at that point, the typical touring ski was, you know. Today we have, you know, we have touring skis that range from anything like a, you know, 140 lightweight carbon fiber, you know, basically a hiking ski, and you don't care how it rides down the slope at night, or a full-on powder ski that's full width, you know, or powder, you know, backcountry. So I think that the tolerance, you know, in the touring ski community, for people that have wider equipment when they hike up is bigger. At that point, people actually started harassing us because they said we mess up their tracks with our wide boards, you know, and they like meticulously build those beautiful tracks, you know, zigzagging up and the whole story. And then we come, you know, we mess up their trucks, and then we just don't follow the figure eight, you know, routine going down, just go straight and just slash here and slash there. You look back up, it's all a big mess, you know. So it was not drastic, but sometimes you ran into like, you guys, you know, sometimes, you know, most of the guys were pretty metal though, because we're just such exotic, you know, beings out there, I think, that most people are like, whoa, you know. But sometimes it was funny because it just didn't fit, you know, the typical expectation of what was out there, you know.
Yeah. Was it hard for you guys to find a skin manufacturer that could make them wide enough for a split?
No. No, we had a guy in Austria, Snowy, I think it was there. I don't know if he's still around. A guy in Austria, actually, it was pretty easy, and they were pretty open. I mean, obviously, at that time, snowboarding was just booming, and they're like, snowboarding, I can participate. So they were readily happy to make skins. The only thing that they didn't make was like specific mounting hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was Velcro, you know. So like we had skins were just like, you know, you just wrap, you know, there's like had Velcro attached to the ends, or even open ends at the tail, which totally suck, you know, if it gets snow underneath or ice, you know. So that was a limitation, but actually finding people that make, you know, skins that fit snowboards was not the big challenge, more like making them really good. But at that point, I think that was maybe asking too much.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't even know what a split board was until, you know, years after this. I was while you were doing this, I was too busy bonking garbage cans on my snowboard in the backyard in Minnesota. But,
yeah.
You know, even our, you know, first couple years that I went to ISPO, so that would have been, you know, I don't know, eight years ago, 7 years ago, something like that. But, you know, I'd be in the like brand new area and I'd have a split board there, and so many ski touring Europeans, that was the first time they had seen one, you know, and this,
there was definitely a big dip in popularity, you know. I mean, for the longest time, we were the only company doing them to begin with. I mean, Burton had one with, I think, a pretty complicated binding system at that point. We had one that was, again, was based on plate bindings. We were, since 95, we were working on another design that to overcome the shortcomings of the hiking part. We had a four-piece board for, you know, a number of years that we never actually put to market. That we built a lot of prototypes and I still have them all, and we played around with that. And it, this was probably the best working one we had ever, because also it kind of coincided with the time when we would have clicker bindings. Like late 90s, you know, clicker became popular, and we kind of teamed up with Shimano and K2, and we made compatible boots and we sold the bindings. And we made, we were able to get away from the plate binding problem, which, you know, at that point, you know, it was not a market anymore. There was no more boots available. So we had a good alternative, you know, and the clicker binding system, you know, they made an adapter plate or just an aluminum plate with a clicker mechanism that just mounted straight onto anything you wanted. So we had a super nice cooperation with a guy who lived about half an hour away, and he's retired, he was a teacher at a like a practical mechanics school, and he was like an avid spitboarding touring guy already in his, you know, I think 60s at that point. And he basically developed all these prototypes with his class, you know, so we designed something together and he'd go back and made the mechanics like metal working class, and they made all the cool prototypes out of titanium, and they had all the cool materials, and we had amazing lightweight equipment, four-piece, you know, split boards, like folding down the middle part, kind of, you know, take it apart, two pods, put it in the backpack for hiking. You know, your skis were wide, narrow enough to fit into the tracks. Like we had adjustable angles, obviously the circular pucks and all this stuff. The problem was just it was just too expensive to make. We got a quote, actually still have a quote from our binding manufacturer, which would have been so expensive. And we figured there's just no way, you know, and that was around, you know, I think 96 or something. And then we decided not to pursue that, you know. And we continued to sell the two-piece one until about 2000, I guess.
Yeah, I'd love to see some pictures of that proto stuff, you can go to market if you have anything.
Yeah, I can send you some photos, easy, no problem. Yeah, they're still all in the basement, in the dungeon.
There you go. I can see why the, you know, because when I was talking to the European folks with the two-piece splits, they're like, oh, it's not going to work, you're going to fall off the skin track, you know, and I was like,
it works,
you know, and like, I make skin tracks, whatever, so, you know, but I can see where you guys were in this big, you know, Alpine areas with these, you know, very well-traveled skin tracks that, you know, pounded in with narrow little skis and stuff, why the, like, 3- and 4-piece splits
it's not even a problem only, like, that people would harass you about it. It's even like, also a technical problem. You know, you run into, like, you try to traverse this slope that gets a bunch of sun, you know, and it kind of, you know, crusts, and it's actually icy crust in the morning, you know. And you just can't fit into those tracks, you know. It's like they're just too narrow, you know. And then, you know, it just wouldn't work, you know. And now it's just different now. Like I said, the reason why we stopped around 2000, I think, was there was alternatives, you know. Like I said, we had this whole clicker thing, you know. K2 did the approach ski. We had MSR snowshoes, you know, with clicker bindings on them, and all this stuff was kind of convenient to use. And they presented alternatives that were easy and kind of accessible somehow. And the other alternative was to make a dedicated splitboard binding, which, you know, for the state the industry was in at that point, was probably not feasible. You know, at least we didn't think it was. You know, maybe it would have been already that new. I don't know. Some guys like you to start that up again, I guess.
I
you know.
I wasn't smart enough to know anything about feasibility, so I went for it.
You need some fresh blood, you know, some, yeah.
Starting a garage.
That's what's so nice about snowboarding in general, you know, and that's why you'll never hear me say anything negative about any new, you know, people brag about, hey, somebody comes up with the new, and they disturb the whole market, and they create all these problems with their newest things in here and there. I mean, that's what we live from, new ideas and people coming in with, without the way of maybe, you know, having gone wrong at some point, you know, like, hey, I'll try this, you know, and maybe it works, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, and do I remember correct that at trade shows, do you guys have a clicker binding coming out for next year, the first time?
Mm-hmm. We're back in business with clicker, yeah. Which I'm personally pretty stoked about. Not so much about a technical discussion about what's better or not, you know. The last thing somebody needs is another battle of five new stepping systems out there.
That's like 90% of all the snowboard patents in the world are on like step-in binding systems from what I've seen.
Yeah, it's crazy. No, I mean, what we need is more like easier accessibility, you know, it needs to be easier. There's a bunch of people that just don't want to bother with, you know, strapping in, you know, they're just over it, you know, they're too old or they don't want to do it with it. I have friends that, you know, they ride with only skiers, like one of our biggest clients in France, you know. He owns, you know, a huge shop, and he's all his friends he's riding with are skiers, and he doesn't like strap and bindings because he said, I just don't want to be the guy everybody's waiting for, and that's it. He doesn't care, you know. He just wants it to hold him down and have a boot that works for him. So I'm stoked, you know, it was interesting because K2 approached us with a quicker when they came out with that, with a backcountry version of it again, and I thought it's cool, but it's too small for us to invest and make a dedicated boot for just that, you know. Now it's like a broad system, and I mean, who knows what the future will bring, you know. I'm all about accessibility, you know. I think that's what snowboarding needs. You know, let's try to make sure that people that want this or that, they just can get onto a snowboard somehow, you know. Mm-hmm. Brings back memories for sure.
You know, it's all circles apparently, so
And that, I think your accessibility thing, you know, as splitboarding kind of became popular again, you talked about the dip and then Nitro was kind of done in 2000. As mm-hmm. the popularity, you know, picked back up again, and it seemed like the equipment kind of followed along with that, with the bindings. But, you know, I think of like the factory boards too, and more brands actually doing that. When did you guys kind of jump back into the splitboard game as it started growing again?
I think about 13, we took at least about a 10-year break. Maybe it was 12 or 13 or something. When I think it was the point where we thought, hey, there's, I think it really the initial, you know, ignition for us was the availability of decent bindings, really, you know. We never really had the intention to manufacture our own bindings. So like, you know, and then there was, you know, the do-it-yourself versions, like, okay. And then at some point there was decent bindings available freely on the market somehow. And of course it was a matter of consumer demand. You know, people come to us, why does everybody make split warnings and you guys know how to make a good snowboard, you know, and you used to do it, why don't you do it again? So we started up again, of course, first with a regular version, and now we have actually four models in the line. You know, and we tried to cover like a more high-end technical lightweight, you know, option, but also like a entry level. Again, talk about accessibility, you know, the overall equipment, you know, bottom line cost is pretty high, you know. So we just try to make our share in trying to offer a board that's, you know, doesn't break the bank and still a good, decent split board. It's good made. So, again, you know, accessibility, you know, trying to, you know, at least give the option to people that, okay, I don't want to spend $2,000 on all this stuff, you know, what else is out there? But to give them a board that works, you know. So yeah, it's amazing. Our split board business grew pretty drastically over the past 3 years. We just looked at numbers again and like, man, this is better than we actually thought it would be, you know, especially with all the competition. Like you said, everybody has a split board, you know.
I think
it's good.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I'm sure Will can speak to this a little bit better, but when you walk around the trade show circuit and, you know, we're looking at what the different brands are putting out, and there's not a ton of people making bindings, but obviously being snowboarders, and we're always curious what everyone's going to come out with, just like the other brands are. And part of the fun is walking into the board builders' booths and seeing what they've got coming up. And just even in the last 3-4 years, it's like, oh, we have a model and it's sort of in the corner, to, oh, we have 3 models and we put it in one of the front spaces so that everyone walking by can get a glance at it. And it's been fun to watch.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, we treated it also, okay, yeah, people asking for it, but let's make one, you know. And it's really changed to like, yeah, you know, this is, you know, it's, and you know, there's, you know, Florian, he's kind of always been his project, you know. I mean, I always do the boards and shapes and everything, but he's always like, okay, let's, you know, let's see what we can do and all this. So, there was always a certain amount of passion for it, you know, especially in the, you know, in the beginning, but now it's really become a bigger focus, you know. Even though I don't know, I mean, I don't know how you see this, like, you know, as far as the market, we see a lot of time and money being spent on ski touring equipment. You know, that segment grew a lot. But what we see here in our local mountain, it's definitely, like I described earlier, that after work exercise person. There's very few snowboarders doing it. I still think the snowboarders that are splitboarding are people that actually enjoy nature and go out and also enjoy the run down, not just the exercise of just hiking up at night. But that's my view. I don't know if you see, you have different experiences, which is cool. You know, I don't know if I want to be too big of a part of just like people up here, just run up there. And as people in Garmisch, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's kind of involved in that, in the, you know, ski touring scene in Garmisch. The people that, you know, they get up there and they have a certain time schedule, I'm talking about ski hiking, to get up there. And in a certain time, not to be, to get the exercise in this time, but to be up there at a certain time so they actually have enough time to catch the last gondola down. You know, and, you know, wow. For me, this is like, well, it's not exactly why I'm into snowboarding, you know. Just sweat and get crazy and get up there and just take the gondola down. So what I'm saying is, I think it's nice to see that, you know, snowboarders are, you know, still focused on riding down. So even our boards, you always try to focus on, you know, making sure the way down is definitely fun, you know.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as far as like people doing it for exercise, it's a pretty regional thing. You know, I think we have some, certainly have some like East Coast customers that are into that side of it. You know, but I think it just depends on where you are. Like our local mountain doesn't allow any uphill travel on like the standard mountain. I think cause they don't want people up top trying to drop in on Powell while they're still bombing it for heavies and stuff. But,
and they would be,
but it just depends on where
you are. It's not a traffic for us. It's a traffic issue. It's a traffic issue that like they don't want people hiking up on or beside the road where people coming down don't expect them. And there's been accidents on that. Like traversing, like all of a sudden, oh, this is fucking steep, I'm going to traverse. And then somebody's just jumping over the crest. And then, and some resorts, even our resort here in town, they actually have dedicated hiking tracks just on the side of the slope with a fence.
Yeah. And they're starting to do that in some spots around here too. I think the next guy has like an uphill zone, but I think it's mostly meant for snowshoes and you know, there's places around. But yeah, I think it's, I mean, you know, to the right minded resort place, they're like, well, this is great, these idiots aren't even taking the lift, so you know, we'll charge them for a pass. And you know,
well, they charge them for the parking now. Parking. They don't charge, I mean, they can't charge them for the lift tickets, but they charge them for the parking spot.
Yeah, well, I think it Yeah,
we'll see how that goes, you know, but I don't know how you see that, but I think we're more part of the backcountry and enjoyment of just riding part of it, you know, the nature of the backcountry, you know, rather than the pure exercise, you know.
For sure. I mean, there's, you know, splitboarding is, you know, a little, it's a little bit interesting compared to skiing, not like quite as efficient, you know, as much as I want to tiptoe around that being on record. So, you know, it's not the most practical means, but I think it's the most fun, you know, so it's kind of, it's sort of built into it there that it's like, yep, you're out there to snowboard. So
that's the point. Yeah, exactly.
We talk about it sometimes, like I would not continue splitboarding if I didn't get the ride down. Like, I'm up there to do that. But there is a certain satisfaction that comes with doing all the work to get up there. And then the turns are even more fun on the way down because you feel like you...
That's the point. The whole thing. Like, remember, we made those kids splitboards a couple years ago. I think we gave you one, right?
It's waiting for because, kids to get big enough to use it.
actually, my son is already outgrowing it. I have to get on back to the drawing board and make another one. But he's maybe, I don't know if he's ready for the smallest girls one yet. But, it's kind of interesting, that's the luxury of doing what we do. Like, we need a kid's spitboard, we just make one, that's it, And I saw him, he's now, 13 now, and he was, when he first went out there, he was, I think 11 even. And he didn't make it all the way up to the top of the mountain, which is from here, it's an hour or so. But he said, when we rode down, he's like, these are the best turns I've ever had in my life, And he's riding quite a bit, and just because you earn every turn, and I think that's the satisfaction you get. And I think there's nothing that compares to it, really, It's like, surfing, you got to paddle out. That's the only way to get there, Okay, you can, get out there on a, ski, on a water ski, whatchamacallit, the water things, the water ski-doos, but typically you paddle out, you gotta, fight your way to get out there, and then of course you earn the return, and I think it's it kind of is the same way, and for me it doesn't mean you have to do a huge high mountain tour. There's around our little town, there's a lot of cool things you can do, 1 to 3 hours, and that's fine, be back in the evening. And that's my next project, make sure my kids enjoy it, that's I think what I want to hopefully do, see if they all get into backcountry snowboarding too.
Well, then that's that's great for that'll be probably the first start of the first generation that's been on the split from so young, most people,
right?
I mean, even until not too long ago, I had good friends of mine that were in their 20s and had been snowboarding for 15 years that just hadn't even seen a splitboard yet, and now it's there are some calls for, the miniature splits, for get kids out there, and makes sense.
We're definitely pushing in that direction, for the next year, we're gonna add sizes on the smaller end of the spectrum. And if it's only to make my kids happy, I guess, I can just do it I just think it's wouldn't be fair to not have that option, and at least to try and make that offering, and if it's accepted, that's great. If not, then at least you try making it,
That's a perfect segue as we kind of wind down here. I was rewatching 28 Winners that you guys put out last year, and I was enjoying that, and I was just kind of trying to think about, just nitro and snowboarding and kind of what we wanted to talk about. And, one thing that I think is clear with anything like that, and, specifically speaking to your, continuing passion for snowboarding, I was just wondering, how, being in the industry that long, how do you just keep that stoke going? How do you keep it alive and stay focused and pumped to stay in the same industry and just go at it day after day?
Well, I think it's for me, it started as a hobby that turned a profession. They say you got a new job, but you lose your hobby. Mm-hmm. Luckily, that's not exactly how it happened for me. And I mean, being a whatever used to be a professional snowboarder in the 80s, not that professional, of course, but to now, my enjoyment is really, I mean, like we just said, it's really riding with my family. You can give me an amazing powder day in a helicopter or, split boards and beautiful, quiet, backcountry zone somewhere. I would still take, a day with my family on the mountain over any of that stuff. That's what keeps me going. Just see my kids grow up into it and getting stoked on it without, and I have to say I never pushed any of my kids on just snowboarding, and they just naturally just picked it up and they're enjoying it on different levels. So I have 3-4 kids, so some of them just occasionally snowboard, others are more active, but they all, when we all go out and ride together, this is pretty much what, man, I see, man, this is so amazing, to see, you know, your family do or enjoy what you spend most of your life with doing, you know, and that, I think that's the main thing that keeps me going, really.
That's awesome. Will, do you have any more questions for Tommy?
Oh, well, I would just double plug on the 28 Winners movie. I would encourage everybody to check that out when I got some free time. I thought it was awesome, so the only thing
Thanks.
The only
Thanks.
Part I thought that was missing was the split board history part, so that's what we're working on.
That's true. Part. Yeah, there was like, in retrospect, there's always something, bang, should have, could have. And yeah, but there's just too much stuff, you know.
Yeah,
but I'm sorry about that.
I'm
so sorry.
Put out a, you know, feature length movie or whatever, so. yeah, I mean, you know, I just really appreciate, you know, you guys have always been very encouraging for what, you know, we've been working on over the years. So I definitely appreciate that. And yeah,
Thanks.
I think you guys are doing great work all around with the line. And yeah, the splits are definitely well represented with Spark employees here. You know, you've got a strong showing there.
That's nice.
Just getting that, you know, the doppelganger model name. I mean, that's an awesome name for a split board. I saw that one, I'm like, oh, it's perfect.
Perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that we got to ride the squash board at the powwow this last year, and that's coming out in a split this fall.
That's coming out as a split. That actually has become probably our best selling split model for next season.
Yeah, so I think that would be a really fun shape for people out there looking for, you know, just that. Powder style board, but you know, the nice thing with those boards is you can ride something really small, so you know, you can, it's a little board, doesn't weigh much, you know, you don't need to have Florian stride to kick turn it.
Thanks. Yeah, you'll actually see a lot more split boarding action with our new movie or whatever is going to be coming of it. We have this spring we did a trip to Norway, Lofoten. It was a pure backcountry only trip, so it was just no lifts, everything hiking. They went up there for 3 weeks just camping out in Norway. The photos we have are absolutely amazing. I don't know when and what we're gonna actually finally put out with that footage, but if it's coming out, it'll be pretty cool. So watch for that.
Awesome. Tommy, thanks again for your time. I know it's getting late there in Germany, but we really appreciate it, and we're, you know, stoked for everything you guys are doing, and definitely happy to chat the early days of splitboarding with you and just the history of it. It's been a lot of fun, so thanks for taking the time, and I guess we'll probably talk to you sometime in the near future, but we'll certainly see you at either SIA or at ISPO when we get all ramped up into trade show season, which is a bit scary to think about, but it's coming fast.
Why you gotta say that, Dan?
Sorry.
Same procedure. Yes. We just had a discussion with the booth people yesterday.
Yeah.
No, last week. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, I actually enjoyed it. It's kind of fun to talk about this stuff. Not to say like we did it all, we did it first, but it's kind of like, man, this is kind of cool, and it's kind of nice to kind of somehow sometimes go through the history and see where it all came from, you know, and see where it's going, or, you know, it's cool, it's fun.
I think it'll be eye-opening for people out there to know that, you know, you guys did get in so early.
So
on it,
early,
you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it all helped get it where it is today, so.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right. Cool. We'll let you go, Tommy, but thanks again, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Talk to you later, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right. My thanks again to Tommy for taking the time to speak with Will and I. This was a fun conversation. Just really cool stuff on those first Nitro split boards. It's fun learning how it all kind of came together. If we can, I'd like to dive into more split history and find some more people to speak with. Will and I have discussed this a little bit and have some good ideas, so hopefully we'll have at least one more split history type podcast coming out this fall. If you'd like to check out some photos of the catalog we referenced in the podcast or some great shots that Tommy sent us afterwards, just check out the links in the show notes. Don't forget that you can rate and review the podcast. Thank you everyone for listening. This has been episode 9 of the Spark R&D podcast.